The War Over Climate.
So my book follows the battle to get this done. And when I started this, Francesca, I thought I was going to be writing a story with a happy ending, frankly, that it would be the story of how we finally took the first step. A funny thing happened on the way to the presidential signing ceremony, and we didn't take that first step.
That's journalist Eric Pooley. We talked to him about the politics of climate change. His book is The Climate War. And what's next on the climate? Will we have to re-engineer the planet to survive? Or will the cure be worse than the disease?
Geoengineering may be something that could be done fairly cheaply, at least initially. I don't think we know quite what the costs would be in terms of the impact on the environment.
That's Eli Kintish. We talked to him about his book, Hacking the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. That's all coming up on Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Record heat in Russia with forest fires raging out of control. Record floods in Pakistan, 20 million people affected. Floods and mudslides in China, 1,200 people dead there. And that's just in 1 week. And more worries. Russia's announced a 30% drop in wheat production and has cut off all wheat exports. From leading climate scientists to Russian President Medvedev, all this havoc is being tied to climate change. But the U.S. Senate hasn't gotten the memo from Mother Nature. It looked like it might happen. Last year, the House passed the Waxman-Markey climate bill. While it wasn't enough to cool the climate, it was a start. But that start is now dead in the water for the foreseeable future. My guest, Eric Pooley, has written a spellbinding political thriller about who killed the climate bill and how they did it. It's called The Climate War. I met with Eric Pooley on a scorching day in New York City, one of many this summer. It was at the Bloomberg building where Pooley works as deputy editor of Business Week. Eric Pooley, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
The personalities and the issues that have framed the war over climate policy is the subject of your book. Let's start with one side of that climate war, the deny and delay movement, as you call them. Could you first tell us who are they and who's behind them?
Well, when I set out to write this book, I didn't expect that that would be a big part of the story because I thought that the debate was shifting from the science to the politics and economics, in other words, from whether climate change was real to what we were going to do about it. But the deny and delay crowd are dedicated to sowing doubt and confusion on this issue, and they've done an extremely good job and have been very persistent. So that question about whether it's really happening or not continues to be a source of real power. It's derailed, or at least helped to derail legislation, because there's about a third of the country that is not at all sure that this is really happening. That didn't happen by accident. That's the result of a concerted effort on the part of paid professional public relations people. The one that I focus on most is a man named Myron Ebell. He's director of global warming policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Now, the CEI is a conservative think tank in Washington that opposes taxation and regulation of any kind. And it's been part of this movement that's been driven by ideology, anti-tax and anti-regulatory zeal to deny the fact of global warming. These are people whose thinking moves from effect to cause. They hate the proposed solutions. They hate the idea of regulating the energy economy. They hate the idea of transitioning from dirty to clean fuels. Not incidentally, they get a lot of funding from the fossil fuel companies. And they're dedicated to a two-front war. One front is the science, and they claim that the jury is still out over whether this is happening. They have a different argument every day. They used to say that there was no global warming. When it became very clear that there was, they retreated to a point where now they say, well, it's happening, but man is not the cause. They argue that it's natural variation, or that it's sunspots, or that if it is happening, we can't do anything about it. They have a different argument depending on the day of the week, sometimes it seems. But it's always consistent that whatever's going on, we shouldn't do anything about it. That's clearly their consistent conclusion. And then the other front that they're fighting on is over the economics. They say that if we do anything about it, it'll break the bank, destroy the economy, drive the price of electricity up, kill jobs, move them to China. The usual scare tactics that you hear from industry anytime a new environmental regulation is proposed.
Now, that last one, the economics, has been getting a lot of play recently, although, as you point out, I'd say probably all of those arguments have been, surprisingly, some of them being resurrected after having been soundly defeated. You call that the big lie of the climate debate. I'd like to go into this a little bit more deeply later on, but if you could just lay that out for us right now, just some of the broad outline of why that is such a big lie.
The big lie of the climate debate is the notion that the economy and the environment need to be in opposition. In other words, that if you do something good for the environment, you're going to do something bad for the economy. This is an argument that dates back to Ronald Reagan, and it's obsolete now, because the fact is we need to do something good for the economy that's also good for the climate and the environment, and that's transition from dirty fuels to clean fuels. Now, that's not to say that there won't be any short-term costs associated with this transition. Clearly, there will. There's always a great churn in the American economy, and my day job is deputy editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, so I'm intimately familiar with economic theory and the churn of a vibrant, changing, ever-evolving American economy. It's like a great river, and it's what the economic theorists call creative destruction. As we move towards new technologies and new industries, older ones get left behind. We're not using buggy whips anymore, and the print media industry is embattled. These things happen as economies go on, and new economies are created. So that's the larger frame. In the energy sphere, we need to move from dirty fuels that have sustained our prosperity and made it possible for the last century or more to cleaner fuels that can sustain our prosperity and make it possible for centuries into the future. Now, as we make this transition, there are going to be winners and losers. And what we have here is the people who think they're going to be the losers trying to prevent the transition from taking place. So they cast this false choice, if you will, between the environment and the economy. They say if we choose the environment, if we choose to do something about climate change, then our beloved American economy is going to crash. That couldn't be further from the truth. There are new industries waiting to be born. There are new industries waiting to create tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of American jobs. All we need to do is level the playing field, take away the subsidies that the fossil fuel industries have long enjoyed, and put a price on carbon, close the carbon loophole that has prevented us from accelerating the transition to clean energies. Now, closing the carbon loophole is really what my book is about. That's what the fight is over. Putting a price on carbon, this great market failure in all of our energy markets around the world that has allowed anybody who wants to spew global warming pollution into the atmosphere for free. And the argument here is that it shouldn't be free. There ought to be a small fee placed on that. And how do you place that small fee? Well, by creating something called carbon permits or carbon allowances, where if you want to be a major league polluter, you have to buy one for each ton of CO2 that you're going to be spewing into the atmosphere. So that is the heart of it. It's putting a mandatory declining cap on carbon emissions, and so far it's something that the United States Senate has been unwilling to do. So my book follows the battle to get this done, and when I started this, Francesca, I thought I was going to be writing a story with a happy ending, frankly, that it would be the story of how we finally took the first step. a funny thing happened on the way to the presidential signing ceremony, and we didn't take that first step. We managed to pass the bill in the House of Representatives, and then the Senate and the president decided that they weren't willing to fight it. They didn't want to go to the mat for this bill in 2009 or 2010. And just a week ago, the Senate pulled the plug on the latest attempt to get something done. The president did not make so much as a peep about it. And they're all still claiming that they're going to be doing it someday, but they keep kicking the can down the road. And at this point, it's a very old can, very battered from many kicks, and a very long road. And we're not making a lot of progress.
I guess a question that came to my mind when that bill failed, and also after reading your excellent piece on that, on why the bill failed, where was that again?
I wrote that for the Yale Environment 360 website. I believe it's www.yalee360.org.
Yes, and we'll link to that writer's voice. And we're talking with Eric Pooley. He's the author of The Climate War, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth. We're talking about the war over climate policy. So my question that really came up is, why does the fossil fuel lobby have so much greater power than all the other U.S. businesses that stand to gain from this or stand to lose from catastrophic climate change?
Well, that's a great question. And the happy thing that's happened in the last couple of years have been a lot of very big, profitable, powerful companies that have stepped forward and said, we have to do this. It's time to put a cap on carbon and a time to accelerate the transition to clean energy. And I'm talking about companies like General Electric and DuPont and Alcoa. And that has broken the de facto veto that big business has held over climate legislation for a decade. However, it wasn't enough to get the job done. The fossil fuel companies are intensely powerful, and the manufacturers are very powerful, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and all of the companies represented there are powerful, and they are still blocking the way forward. Let's break it down. Inside the electric utility industry, which is the sort of sharp tip of the spear here, because that's probably where we'll begin the regulatory push, there are companies who have already decarbonized. They're already getting a lot of their power from hydro, from nuclear, and beginning to get a lot more of it from solar and wind. And they are saying, yes, let's cap carbon, let's accelerate. Then there are utilities that are getting their energy still from coal and natural gas, and they're saying, no, let's not do this. And it's really the coal-based utilities that have been dragging their heels and preventing change in tandem with the oil companies and the National Association of Manufacturers and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, two big, powerful industry lobbies that have been opposed to doing this. They have a lot of money to spend. They have a lot of clout on Capitol Hill, and there are about a dozen senators, either from states that get a lot of their electricity from coal or states that produce coal, who have been blocking the way forward. And the politics inside the Senate, as you know, you need 60 votes to do anything. So even if we have a slight majority, 50 or 52 people in the Senate who are willing to vote for this, that's not enough. We need to get to 60 to get it done. And so far, we have not been able to do that. Now, why haven't we been able to? I believe the most important reason is that the President of the United States has not gotten in there and fought for a bill. Obama has done a lot on climate, especially in the Department of Energy. They've spent billions of dollars to accelerate electric vehicle production, battery factories in the U.S. There are 17 new electric vehicle battery factories up and running or under construction in the state of Michigan alone. So that's one of the things Obama has done. He's also put through new fuel efficiency standards that reduce emissions from car tailpipes, and he's moved the EPA towards stationary regulation of factories and power plants that's supposed to kick in next year, although that's going to be another big battle. So don't get me wrong, the president has done a lot, and he's done more than any president in history. Where he has fallen down has been on the single most important thing, putting a price on carbon through a cap. And There, he has talked a good game, but the truth is he has not stepped up. He has not put his considerable power behind a specific piece of legislation. He has not told the Senate what he wants. And he has not led on three levels. The level of sustained, deep communication to the American people, explaining why we need to do this, why we need to transition to clean energy and how we're going to get it done, why a carbon cap is so important. He hasn't really made that case. He's made it intermittently, usually on a Tuesday afternoon in a visit to a solar factory that doesn't get a lot of attention. When he did his Oval Office speech to the nation after the BP oil spill, he missed an enormous opportunity to tell people what we need to do and why. He actually said, we don't know precisely how we're going to get there. We have a roadmap, but we need to share it with people. And the president chose not to. So that was a bitter disappointment to the heroic people who have been campaigning for climate legislation at the federal level. So communication is one place where Obama has not stepped up. Another is, as I mentioned, policy, getting deeply engaged with the Senate on a particular piece of policy. And the third is good old-fashioned politicking and bending some arms to try to get those votes. You know, when we passed the bill in the House a year ago, Nancy Pelosi and Henry Waxman brought the bill to the House floor without having the votes in place, and they forced the president's hand. And for a week or 10 days, Obama whipped that vote, and he really worked hard, and they won. Now the president and his political advisors have been saying, well, we don't have the votes in the Senate, so we're not going to take it to the floor. Well, we didn't have them in the House either, and we got there because we went for it. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you say you don't have the votes, you're not going to have the votes. And look, I know the Senate is harder than the House. It's very difficult to get there. It's not something that you can do in a week or even a month. That takes sustained effort from the president, and so far he's not been willing to do it.
Why didn't Obama do this?
Well, Obama gets the climate threat, and he wants to do it. He thinks that the time is wrong politically. And I don't have to tell anybody what a tough time it's been for the American economy, how many folks are out of work, and how hard it is to talk about anything that would impose further short-term costs on the American people. The costs that we're talking about, the cost of imposing a cap on carbon, are very, very low. According to the EPA and the Congressional Budget Office and all of the best academic studies, we're talking about maybe $70 to $140 a year in additional costs to a household, middle-income household, by 2030. Now, that's not a lot of money. What's more, the low-income people would be completely shielded from these costs because there are really smart people creating mechanisms that make sure that there's a cushion for any low-income American. In fact, would come out ahead from these bills because they'd be given rebates that would make sure that they don't incur any additional costs. So these are scare tactics, but they're scare tactics that the administration apparently thinks are so effective that they're not willing to take them on. And it's a shame because we know that the high growth path into the future, the long-term upside is so great from getting on this clean energy trail that we really have no reason not to do it. And in fact, I just wrote a piece for Business Week last week, which makes the argument that we're already losing and may even have lost the clean energy race to China. There is more investment, private investment, going into clean energy in China than going into the U.S. and Europe combined. And China is spending $9 billion a month on clean energy technology, and it plans to spend hundreds of billions of dollars over the next decade to accelerate these. If we want to keep up with the Chinese, we need a market. We need a price on carbon. The president gets this. His economic advisors have talked about a scissors approach to economic recovery. A scissors has two blades. The first blade was the stimulus package, and there was about $60 or $70 billion that went into clean energy in the stimulus package. The second blade of the scissors would be the cap, and that would bring a lot of private investment off the sidelines. But we haven't done the cap yet, so our scissors is missing a blade.
Tell us more now about cap and trade. You know, the other policy has been a carbon tax. There's been a controversy between the two. In your book, Eric Pooley, The Climate War, I think you give probably the clearest explanation of what the cap actually does, what cap and trade does, which has been something that a lot in the environmental community have looked upon with a certain degree of skepticism.
It's true. The cap and the idea of cap and trade has been demonized by both the right and the left. And it's a lot of folks think it's really complicated. It's actually pretty simple if you break it down into two parts. The part that really matters is the cap. That's the mandatory declining limit on carbon pollution. We measure it. We say this is how much we can emit in a year, and we ratchet that down over time. The part that's been most demonized and most misunderstood is the trade. That's really a way to manage costs. It's a way to keep costs down for the companies that have to clean up their act. And there are different ways of doing the trade. And frankly, it's all about politics when you get to the trade part. It's all about costs and arguing over who bears the cost. The cap is the important part, and that's what we need to get done. The trade is whatever approach we can get the most votes to get this thing through. Whether it's a cap and dividend approach where you rebate all the money back to Americans, or whether it's a trade approach where you sell allowances and let them be traded between major emitters, or whether it's a allowance auction approach where you sell some of the allowances and you give other allowances for free to the emitters with the proviso that they have to pass on the savings to their customers. I talked earlier about some of the smart ideas for cushioning folks from the effect of this, and that's one of the smart ideas. This has been, on the left, sold as a windfall for polluters, where, in fact, if the law says that the polluters have to pass on their savings to their customers, it's not a windfall. But, you know, we can debate those various approaches, and we can also debate a carbon tax, and I would be happy with any of those approaches. My problem is that the left spends all its time arguing over what's better. The right spends all its time demonizing the approach that came the closest to passing. And as a result, we got nothing done.
Those who in the environmental community who have tried to get something done have tried to bring together those two ideas of the environment and economics. As you pointed out, the right has said it's too expensive to protect the environment. The left has said we can't take care of profits and protect the environment at the same time. We need to put the environment first. Tell us about the Environmental Defense Fund and the NRDC, the National Resources Defense Council. What's been their approach with environmental economics?
EDF and NRDC are the two mainstream groups who have really been inside the room trying to cut the deal with utilities, big companies, and the senators to try to get something done. They've taken some flack from environmental groups outside the room for being too ready to compromise with polluters. My own view is that we need all of these approaches. We need people outside the room arguing for more and better, and I have enormous respect for the groups like Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, and others who are saying we need to keep in mind that this is the future of our planet we're talking about, the habitability of the Earth and our stewardship of nature, and we can't just bargain it away. So that's an incredibly important point. I'm also mindful that the political system is the only vehicle we have for getting something done. So it's not like we can say, oh, compromise is such a mistake, let's go do this some other way. There is no other way. This is how we create change in America. So I also think the people inside the room trying to cut a deal are doing an important service, and you need them both, because you need the people outside the room to keep the folks inside the room honest and make sure that the deal is worth doing. So what is the deal? Well, the deal was, let's set a mandatory declining limit on carbon pollution, and let's give free allowances to some of the emitters to get them on board, and let's also let them use something called offsets, which are carbon credits for emissions reductions outside the system that can do things like fund avoided deforestation in the tropical rainforests and other kinds of emissions reduction systems that can help us in the fight against carbon emissions, because the atmosphere doesn't care where these emissions reductions come from. They don't care if it's a coal-fired plant in Toledo or a rainforest that you don't burn down in Papua New Guinea. Any reductions are good for the planet. So offsets are another incredibly controversial part, because they're seen as letting polluters off the hook.
But they're also seen as being very subject to corruption and gaming the system.
Well, they are, and indeed there have been situations where they have been subject to corruption and to gaming. There's a set of offsets through something called the Clean Development Mechanism in the UN system, where China has taken a lot of money for projects that would have happened anyway. There are some horror stories there. But the good news is a lot of that has been cleaned up. And in fact, the CDM process just turned down a whole bunch of Chinese wind projects and didn't give them offset status through the CDM because they were going to be built anyway. They were so-called anyway tons. They would have happened, reductions that would have happened no matter what. So we've learned from our mistakes here, and I think we've cleaned up a lot of the excesses. Obviously, offsets need to be real, they need to be verifiable, and they need to be permanent. And if you can do that, I think they need to be part of the system, because they're a way to lure in not only the American polluters, but also other countries that don't need to be part of the global system, but it can bring them into play. So I don't think offsets ought to be thrown out, but I do think they ought to be strictly regulated. My preference would be by the EPA. So we're talking about all these things, offsets, carbon allowances, cap and trade. The fact is the Senate hasn't acted. It may be a couple of years or more before we get back to this debate in the United States Senate. Does that mean it's over? No, it doesn't mean it's over, because the EPA is moving ahead with regulation of stationary sources that may, for all we know, include some form of a cap and some form of trading to reduce costs. The EPA is going to unveil its policies in September, and they're due to take effect in January, and they'll be, or at least to begin rolling out in January. There will be lawsuits. There will be attempts to roll back EPA regulation in the Senate. There will be what Representative John Dingell described as a glorious mess of litigation and regulation. It's going to be lawsuits on the local level. Each power plant that EPA tries to regulate is going to be subject to litigation. There are going to be delays and confusion. It's going to take some time. Meanwhile, you've also got regional cap-and-trade systems that have been set up in the Northeast, in the West. About half the country by the end of 2012 will be under some form of a cap-and-trade regime for the electric sector. So we're moving ahead with this, even though the Senate isn't willing to act. And the hope is that we can do enough at the local, regional, and EPA level that we can keep this going until the Senate is ready to get going itself.
Eric Pooley on the climate war. Stay tuned for more after the break. But first, here's something to chew on. You think cutting carbon will be expensive? Well, here's the cost of continuing on the current path, $1,240 trillion. That's about 20% of global GDP. The cost of cutting emissions, somewhere between 2 and 3%. Of course, the longer we wait, the more expensive it'll be. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Before the break, our guest Eric Pooley was talking about some end runs we might be able to do around the Senate's inaction on energy and the climate, like regional cap-and-trade systems or using the EPA to regulate emissions. But those can be held hostage to politics, too. You say that we have to deal with the political system that we have, and you've just talked about some of the regional initiatives that are there, but they also are subject to politics. Right now in California, as we do this interview, there's a move to take back a very innovative and forward, probably the best climate policy in the nation is being done in California, is going into effect in California, and there's a referendum to repeal it. And regionally, there can always be problems with, if you don't have a national policy, then you can play regions against each other. In other words, businesses can just elect to go elsewhere, let's say. So that brings us to another great part of a pressure point, and that is a social movement. Al Gore has been trying to develop that movement. You talk about that in your book, to use the media to build the political will. I'd like to start out this part by asking you to talk a little bit about that, and then I'm going to follow it up with kind of where are we going on that?
Well, I'd hate to think where we'd be in this battle without Al Gore. He gets criticized a lot. He's a lightning rod for partisan attacks. Because he had the guts to step up in 2006 with an Inconvenient Truth and tell everybody what was happening. And that was a galvanic moment in America. It was a moment when a lot of people began to take this issue seriously. Now, Gore had been talking about it for 20 years before that, and so had a lot of other people. But that was a turning point in American life. And Gore saw that he wasn't going to be able to do it himself, and that he needed a movement to get this done, that America needed a movement, and that there was so much opposition and disinformation that we needed somebody to bring the tools of mass persuasion to bear on the side of the planet, because a lot of people were using PR and advertising on the side of the fossil fuel companies. So he wanted to even the playing field a bit, if you were, and he created the Alliance for Climate Protection to spend $300 million on state-of-the-art advertising over 3 years. And he thought that in that time we would pass a climate bill in the United States and then a global deal, that it was supposed to be a climate bill in the U.S. by 2009 so that we could take a great step forward in the Copenhagen summit in December of 2009 and take a first step toward a global deal. You know, the whole world, Francesca, has been waiting for the U.S. to get serious about this, and we can't get a global deal done until the U.S. actually passes an aggressive climate bill. It's just not going to happen until we take the first step, because we left the whole world hanging at Kyoto when everybody else signed on but us, that is all the other developed countries, and we alone in the developed world have said we won't put that treaty into force. So, of course, it wasn't as effective without American leadership as it could have been. So we really need to step up on this issue. People say, well, what about China? What about India? Well, America has to go first. Without American leadership, we had a century-long head start over China and India toward American prosperity, the so-called American century. Because we benefited from that, we need to lead now. And we can't expect China to go at the same moment we do, or let alone go first. We have to go first. So that's been Al Gore's message. He's been trying to educate Americans about the climate threat, about the potential for a clean energy economy, about the urgency and solvability of this crisis, the fact that we need to get going now, but that we have the tools to do it. And he's done everything he knows how. He's, in my view, done a good job. People blame Al Gore and they say Al Gore has failed because we haven't passed a bill. I don't think it's about Gore, or I don't think it's fair to say Gore has failed. I think the failure is ours. I think Americans need to step up. This is not a spectator sport. You can't sit back in your chair and watch Al Gore and say, is he getting it done? We've got to get it done. We've got to step up. We've got to contact our politicians. And if we believe that a transition to a clean energy economy is going to be good for America, we have to let people know that. So I believe we live in a participatory democracy, and I think people need to make their voices heard. And certainly Gore has been frustrated that the movement has not taken off to the extent that he would like it to. He's still optimistic that it will. And frankly, there is no plan B. When you need to reduce industrial emissions, you got to reduce emissions. There's no other way around it. And as Gore told me in Copenhagen, the fact that this is hard to do doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it. You know, we need to do this. People say it's hard. Let's do something else. Let's wait for a silver bullet technology that's going to get this done for us. Well, you know, we don't believe in the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy anymore, and we shouldn't believe that someone is going to come along and fix this problem for us. We have to fix it ourselves, and the way that we're going to accelerate the technology that we need is by putting a cap on carbon, or, God knows, putting a carbon tax in place. I'd be happy to do that, too.
I couldn't agree with you more about the need for Americans to step up. The one place where I have some doubts is about the participatory democracy, because poll after poll has shown, even latest polls have shown, that large majorities of the American people are in favor of climate policy that will really tackle the issue, and particularly if you can tell them that it's going to be good for the economy as well. And yet nothing is moving, and probably nothing is moving because there's such a lack of lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry on Congress. What do you think can break that lock?
Well, I think the people's voice can break that. And the fact is there is a majority in favor of climate action. It varies from the, you know, 55% to 75%, depending on the poll you look at and how the question is asked. But there is a majority. That said, if you ask people, what's the most important issue to you? Climate change won't even come up on the top 10. So it's not an issue that has a great deal of resonance with a lot of people. And people need to start talking about it more. The trouble is, it still seems abstract to a lot of people. You know, it's funny, but in the course of a long, hot summer, it polls higher than it does in the winter. We are such reactive creatures that when it's 102 degrees in New York City, people start worrying about climate change. When it's 20 degrees in New York City, people don't worry about it as much. Let me tell you, it's as big a problem in the winter as it is in the summer, because our winter is someone else's summer, and what's happening is happening globally. That's why they call it global climate change. We need to get over this fact that you know, that whether we happen to have a hot day or a cold day has any bearing on what's happening long term to our climate. And we need to wake up and smell the coffee about what the effects are going to be. There's a new book out by Heidi Cullen called The Weather of the Future, which talks about how the weather is going to be changing as the climate changes just over the next 20, 30 years. We're not talking about something that's going to be happening in the distant future anymore. The change is upon us. And the trouble is, we can't wait until we experience all those changes. Then it's going to be too late. We need to get going now. So there are people that think we can't afford to wait until there's a popular movement. The trouble is that if you look at American history, the transformative legislation that has passed the Senate and the Congress tends to be aided and abetted by the voice of Americans. The civil rights legislation, even health care last year and early this year. When people speak up, things begin to change, and people need to speak up on this issue.
Eric Pooley, your terrific book will help Americans do that. It's called The Climate War, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth. Thanks so much.
Francesca, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It was a good conversation.
You can read Eric Pooley's blog post on the Senate's failure to pass the climate bill by going to writersvoice.net. You'll also find a link to a report from the Presidential Climate Action Project on what Obama could do right now to tackle the climate crisis without Congress. And next up, hacking the planet. We talk with Eli Kintish about some extreme measures against climate change. Researchers in Europe have just come out with a new climate change model that says the tipping point for runaway climate change is a whole lot closer than we thought. 2015, a mere 5 years from now. If we don't start cutting global carbon emissions by then, we're toast. Literally. Or are we? Is there another approach? One that can buy us time? It's the engineering that dare not speak its name. Geoengineering. That's what science reporter Eli Kintish writes about in his book, Hack the Planet. It's controversial. For one, when you start messing around with Mother Nature, there could be some serious unexpected blowback, like cutting off so much light from the sun, crops can't grow. On the other hand, what we're doing to the climate may force us to consider geoengineering, just to buy us time. Eli Kentish, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thanks, Francesca. Glad to be here.
Now, in Hack the Planet, which is about the geoengineering of the planet to avert climate catastrophe, you say that it's the engineering that dare not speak its name. Why is that?
For a number of years, Francesca, the idea of actually using climate science to imagine changing the planet's temperature or climate directly was a kind of rogue concept, and scientists who talked about it did it among themselves, and they weren't really accepted at the major meetings or journals for climate science. And the reason, I think, is that the powers that be with among climate scientists know that while we understand the big questions about climate, that the planet is warming and that human activity is largely responsible and that the risks of that could be incredible, we don't know the answers to the small questions, the role of aerosols in the atmosphere, for example, or where all of the carbon goes after it's emitted. And so the idea of actually coming up with deliberate means of controlling the atmosphere is, to most scientists, kind of a disturbing concept, given those uncertainties. But that's changed in the last 3 years because scientists have come to worry that even if we were to pass our most aggressive greenhouse gas cuts, which, by the way, is a bit of a stretch, we may still see some pretty bad scenarios for the warming planet, and that some very responsible scientists have thought that we might need an alternative strategy, or at least a parallel strategy.
In other words, to try to go along with cutting our carbon emissions to try to find some way to protect the planet from heating.
Right. The other reason that it was the engineering that dare not speak its name is that scientists really feared if you talked about some sort of cooling mechanism for the atmosphere, you might dissuade people that we have to take aggressive steps to stop putting up all the pollution we're putting up with carbon emissions. But actually, geoengineering would only work as a kind of parallel procedure. You have to be cutting the greenhouse gases which are warming the planet at the same time that you even consider cooling means.
One of the methods that you talk about is by injecting aerosols into the atmosphere, sulfur dioxide, much like Pinatubo, the Pinatubo solution, or as we're seeing now, the Iceland volcano, which is doing that. Gee, Mount Pinatubo doesn't seem to have hurt the climate of the Earth. It protected us, gave us a few more years of cooling. What's the downside?
Mount Pinatubo erupted in 1991. It spewed about 10 million tons of sulfur into the stratosphere, the upper part of the atmosphere above the weather. And that sulfur pollution actually blocked a certain fraction of the sun's rays and cooled the planet by a degree Fahrenheit over a year. And so scientists have thought, well, geez, if we could, you know, try this so-called Pinatubo option, as they call it, we might be able to mimic that cooling effect, but do it with engineering. The problem is that among the side effects that volcanoes cause is that they can rob the planet of the sort of solar energy which drives rainfall. And that solar energy drives rainfall by evaporating moisture. And what we saw after Pinatubo, actually, and there was a paper about this, is that since there was less solar radiation striking the Earth, there was less evaporation, and streams, you know, monitors on streams showed less water surging through them, and there was a measure of less precipitation. And so the fear is that if you were to exercise this Pinatubo option, for example, and put up your own sulfur pollution into the stratosphere, you might rob the planet of energy needed for rain.
Eli Kentish, your book, Hack the Planet, really explores some of the upsides and a whole lot of the downsides of monkeying with the planet. It shows some of the unintended consequences of technological experiments that have already been done. You have these little vignettes throughout the book of ways in which human beings have tried to correct some imbalance in the environment and have ended up screwing it up even more. For example, one of the things you talk about is unintended consequences is the attempt to clean up the air might even be exposing us to even more sunlight, even more heating. If we can't even clean up the atmosphere for our own health without running into a problem, then how do you deal with this conundrum of even sticking our toe into the idea of geoengineering?
The short answer is as cautiously as possible. We're kind of doing inadvertent geoengineering right now, and people don't really appreciate this. As we clean the air of traditional air pollutants, mostly sulfates, which come from diesel engines and mostly from power plants, as we clean the air over cities from that pollution, we reduce an important sort of cooling tool. Those particles actually scatter away from the Earth a fraction of the sun's rays, and that's one of the reasons you see a kind of dark haze over cities when it's smoggy. And so we've actually realized that cooling effect that these aerosol particles that we put up as a result of traditional air pollution, that could have this really big global effect. And it's a mysterious effect, though, and scientists don't know if it's responsible for a small fraction of the warming, something like, let's say, a quarter of the warming that the greenhouse gases are causing might be offset by this aerosol effect from pollution, or it might be as much as a half. And that is a big difference, because if we're masking right now through this inadvertent geoengineering as much as a half of the warming that the greenhouse gases are causing, that means as we clean our air, we're going to see a lot more warming with the same greenhouse gas pollution. And it also means that the climate conundrum that we've gotten ourselves into is worse than we know.
Now, there are two basic approaches that you talk about in your book, Hack the Planet, to geoengineering. One is to deflect sunlight, and the other is one of which we've already talked about, the injecting of sulfur aerosols into the atmosphere, the Pinatubo option. And the other is to take CO2, carbon dioxide, out of the atmosphere. Could you explain these two methods and then tell us which do you think are the most promising?
So first, let's step back and say why we're in this problem. The greenhouse gases are sort of common pollutants, which it turns out warm the planet more than we thought they did. And they do that by trapping heat that's reflected by the surface of the planet before it can get back out to space. So that's the greenhouse effect. And so the two ways that scientists have thought of dealing with this problem is first to reduce the greenhouse effect, and that's by lowering our emissions of greenhouse gases, but also to cool the planet directly through geoengineering. But geoengineering has these two sides. You could cool the planet, but as we said with the Pinatubo option, putting up volcano-like pollution into the stratosphere, or other methods like brightening clouds or even changing the brightness of the ocean surface. There's a guy who's suggested giant swaths of bubbles that you could add to the ocean, and those bubbles would make the surface of the ocean brighter. But that's the cooling side. To deal more directly with the problem of the greenhouse gases, we might want to go beyond simply cutting our greenhouse gas emissions by using solar panels or using windmills. We might actually want to suck the carbon dioxide right out of the sky. And so scientists have started to build machines which might actually filter the atmosphere of carbon dioxide. And in terms of the most promising methods, one thing that cools the planet is to put a roof on your house that's white. And that has added benefit of keeping your house cool in the summertime. They don't think that white roofs could have a global effect if everyone did them. Turns out cities are just too small to have that kind of effect and some other reasons. But that's a good way to cool the planet that has the added benefit of cooling your house. In terms of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, stopping deforestation leads to putting up less carbon in the air, and it allows the Amazon and other tropical forests to continue to take in carbon dioxide. Building carbon-sucking machines is actually probably a pretty good idea, just because we might need them, and there's really no downside in the future to sucking that carbon dioxide out of the sky. The problem is it's way too expensive, and so we need research on it to find out if it could work, 20, 30 years from now.
Where do you put all that carbon once you've sucked it out of the sky?
Well, let's hope that 20, 30 years from now, we have a better solution than we do now. Right now, the idea with coal plants is instead of spraying their carbon dioxide into the air, it's to shove it deep down into the into the ground. But there are some possible problems with that, although so far initial studies suggest that it will be fairly feasible to do. It may be more expensive than we hope, and it could add considerable cost to everyone's energy bills to have to store the carbon dioxide underground that we right now spray into the sky. But with the carbon dioxide sucking methods right now, the best idea is to put it underground.
People talk about carbon capture and storage or clean coal. Do you think the major problem is that it's too expensive, or do you see other downsides?
Right now, no one would mind if it was cheap to simply take the coal plants we have and start emitting the carbon that's coming from and then putting it underground. The problem is that coal is a dirty business. You know, like oil, like we're seeing in the Gulf of Mexico, you know, it's an inherently unsustainable way to get energy. And so one fear that people have is that by allowing so-called carbon capture and storage as a solution for coal, you simply keep coal plants around, whereas maybe they say the better solution is to ban coal plants or to ban new ones, at least, that don't store carbon dioxide.
Now, another carbon-sucking solution you talk about in the book, Hack the Planet, Eli Kintesh, is Calera cement, turning carbon into limestone, basically. Talk about that and tell us, what are some of the challenges of that as well?
If you think about where oil comes from and where coal comes from, basically you have creatures, you know, that form limestone as the shells of their... They basically have coral shells, kind of bone shells that's made. And then as that gets processed under the weight of the ocean, it forms limestone. And then as it gets further and further processed, it turns into other things like coal and oil and natural gas. So the idea is that when the CO2 is emitted by a coal plant, why not use chemical means to turn it back into limestone, into hard stuff? And so this is how animals make shells, this is how animals make pearl, this is how we make bones and teeth, we make hard stuff out of carbon. But the problem with this method is that it's really unproven, and that while the company selling it, Calera, is convinced that it could be the solution for coal plants in the future, there are a lot of questions surrounding it, and it's yet to really prove itself as a viable alternative to simply shoveling the carbon dioxide underground.
Now, you are talking in the book, Hack the Planet, about solutions that are really worldwide in application, or geoengineering, changing the climate, hopefully in a good direction. One of those is the fertilization of oceans by iron, talking about using even a very small amount of iron to change the oceans. Why would this work? What's this about?
So in my book, I describe a kind of fascinating figure named John Martin, who towards the end of his life realized that one of the reasons that whole swaths of the ocean have lots of nutrients but no sea life, essentially, is that a trace nutrient, iron, is missing. And one of these places is the Southern Ocean, which is the ocean that rings Antarctica. And so Martin proposed that maybe in the past there was more iron in these waters, and that's why there were more plankton, which is the main plant of the ocean, and that plankton, you know, allowed there to be much more sea life than there is now. And so he said, well, geez, maybe we can provide the iron ourselves. And he made this famous comment, as he said in his best Dr. Strangelove voice, give me a tanker of iron and I can give you an ice age. So several companies have looked into the idea of adding the trace nutrient of iron to the ocean, because that trace nutrient could catalyze the growth of algae, which would suck carbon dioxide out of the sky. And as that algae was eaten or it died, it would bring the carbon dioxide that was in the air before to the bottom of the ocean. And in my book, I describe this sort of revolutionary mission by Indian and German scientists to try this on a large scale, because iron fertilization had been attempted by a number of scientists working on small scale, like small experiments, and they wanted to do it something like, I think, I don't remember, but many, many tons, I think it was 10 tons of iron they were going to add to the ocean. And that amount would catalyze enormous blooms of algae. And this ran into a lot of controversy, because the environmental ministry of Germany was at odds with the science ministry, which had approved the mission. It was a German ship. And so I describe in my book how the scientists, in the middle of their ocean cruise, in the absolute end of the Earth, deep in the southern hemisphere, in just the most desolate seas you can imagine, they were up all night writing scientific papers to convince the government to allow them to do this experiment. It turned out the experiment didn't work for a number of reasons. Mostly they were growing the wrong kind of algae. But it's a good example of how controversial this topic can be.
Well, it's controversial also because algae blooms can lead to sucking all the oxygen out of, that's what happens in some local areas where there are algae blooms in the ocean because of, agricultural fertilizers
there. Right. Yeah, you have to be careful when you're messing with large-scale systems. A number of scientists have basically said that iron fertilization is a bad solution to our global climate problem and our global carbon problem. On the other hand, I point out, we put up 8 billion tons of carbon every year with man-made emissions. You know, if this particular solution could take as much as, one-eighth of that, 1 million tons a year, and store it in the ocean, which already takes in many hundreds of times more carbon than that by natural means, it shouldn't be taken off the table. And that's what other scientists think.
You sound more positive in talking with us here than you actually do in your book, Eli Kintish, in Hack the Planet. In the book, you do explore a lot of the dangers of geoengineering. And I found fascinating, toward the end of the book, you also talk about geoengineering as being a right-wing darling, that this is a solution that's being touted by the right wing, a right wing that has for a long time denied the reality of global warming. Talk about the politics around this and why are conservatives, right-wing conservatives, interested in this?
I mean, I can't get into anyone's head per se, but I will say that the idea of geoengineering does allow discussion of a number of kind of classic talking points when it comes to climate change, that you hear from, folks who want to continue emissions the way they are. The first is that this is a problem about temperature and not about carbon dioxide. And so if you make this a problem of temperature, then a solution which focuses on temperature, like the Pinatubo option, where we block a certain fraction of the sun's rays, that might make more sense than talking about cutting emissions, if that's your worldview. The second thing is that, there's a lot of talk about how difficult or expensive cutting emissions like Obama wants to do, how expensive that would be. And geoengineering, by contrast, may be something that could be done fairly cheaply, at least initially. I don't think we know quite what the costs would be in terms of the impact on the environment or social costs or whether this would lead to inequity or it could even lead to war, you don't know. But at least initially, the cost of actually putting up pollution into the stratosphere to block 2% of the sun's rays may be on the order of a couple billion dollars a year, which is, frankly, nothing when you think about the global economy. And finally, I think that geoengineering allows us to think about this as a problem which may not require kind of massive changes in our lifestyle, which some people think would be a bad idea. I think what we learned from the BP oil spill is that even if carbon emissions wasn't the problem that it is, there are lots of reasons to trying to be moving towards a more sustainable way of living.
Eli Kintish, your book is Hack the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. It's a great book, and thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Francesca.
Eli Kintish is a reporter for Science Magazine, and he's also written for Slate, Discover, and The New Republic. You can read an excerpt from Hack the Planet at writersvoice.net. And you can delve deeper into the politics of climate change and geoengineering with more links you'll find on our website. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows.